lost the weight upon my shoulder. Now it's easier to walk. I can see the road before me. I am not afraid to fall.
All right, welcome to the podcast today. We are so excited. We have a really awesome, unique episode today.
So interesting.
Yeah.
You guys to listen and to share this episode.
Yes, yes. It's Elizabeth and Deborah. And yes, you're going to be able to get to hear all about them and you're going to love them. They basically, the short summary of it is they're best friends. They've connected through poetry and they're going to share just poems sprinkled throughout this that we think you guys are going to love.
Right. And they live such a different life than we lived. Mm-hmm. They kind of grew up in California during the hippie era and they're just these just cute and thoughtful. And I loved it. They responded back to us after the episode. And they're like, thank you so much for this soulful conversation. Yeah, and that's kind of how I felt after.
Totally. Yeah.
Like, so we, soulful.
Yes. Yeah. I loved it. It was so good. And then we just wanted to clarify in it. We referenced Jorge's interview that we did. And so if you want to go back and listen to that, we'll talk more about him in the episode, but he was a student of theirs. And so that was
in
released
in the prison. Yeah.
Yeah. In the prison. And that was released November 28th, 2023. So after you listen to this, we highly recommend listening to Jorge's if you haven't.
And then when they say George in this episode, Jorge and George are the same person.
Yeah, same person. Yeah, just we both reference them differently here and there. So, yeah. But they sent us a really awesome kind of summary previous to us doing this episode, and we didn't end up reading it in the episode itself. So Chantel's going to read that just to give you guys a little more background about them.
Okay, so when Deborah Tobola and Elizabeth Buckner met at the California Men's Colony in 2000, they became friends at first sight. They recognized that they were members of the same tribe, creatives, in the harsh, highly structured environment of prison. Deborah managed the prison arts program, and Elizabeth taught the under 21 prisoners. They spent lunches together in the arts and corrections building. A pivotal moment occurred when Elizabeth discovered a gifted young poet, Jorge Nunez, in her class and sent him to see Deborah. She offered him a job as the creative writing clerk. All he had to do was write poems and assist her with the poetry class. He accepted. Fast forward 24 years, Deborah and Elizabeth are still friends and members of three writing groups. They're also friends with Jorge Nunez, their former student. They have experienced and witnessed the power of poetry as a catalyst for survival and healing. Yeah. I think it's a really good summary without giving you guys too much info of the episode. So we hope you enjoy it and feel soulful or inspired as we did after.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Welcome to the Beautiful Shifts podcast today. We're so excited to have some friends of Jorge Nunez. If you listened to his episode back in November, is that when you decided it was? End of November. So we have Deborah and Elizabeth with us. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Ladies, I should say.
Yeah.
We're very excited to have you. We're going to first read their bios so you can get to know them a little bit and then jump into their stories. I'll start out with Deborah. Deborah Tobola is a poet, memoirist, playwright, and co-author of a children's book. Her work has earned 4 Pushcart Prize nominations, 3 Academy of American Poets Awards, and a Children's Choice Book Award. Her memoir, Hummingbird in Underworld, Teaching in Immense Prison, received positive reviews in the Los Angeles Times and the Los Angeles Review of Books. It also won several awards in the categories of social justice, social issues, creative nonfiction, and heroic journeys. Tobola spent 30 years working as a prison arts instructor, teaching creative writing and theater. Tobola founded Poetic Justice Project, the country's first theater company for formerly incarcerated people in Santa Maria, California in 2009.
Okay, and then we've got Elizabeth's bio here. So before dedicating herself to poetry, Elizabeth Buckner was a welfare worker in Los Angeles and San Francisco for 4 years and a prison educator in San Luis Obispo County for 30 years, with a stint in San Francisco as a substitute school bus driver in between. Her poems are her life stories written in shorthand, distilled to their essences. She has self-published 2 books of poetry, Naked Lady, 2012, and Spirits in 2016. She recently republished an expanded version of Naked Lady, a poetic memoir of rape and recovery. Both books are available on Amazon Kindle and Apple Books.
Okay, that's quite the bios.
Yeah.
Super impressive.
Yeah.
Maybe we could start with each of you giving us any more information you want about yourselves. Elizabeth, if you want to start.
Let Deborah.
Okay.
So ahead. We met 24 years ago in prison, and we were instantly friends. And Jorge, who we met as George, was a student of each of us. And we ended up traveling after he was deported. We traveled to Tijuana to see how he was doing.
I love that. And yeah,
have had other adventures, but I think poetry is foundational to our friendship. And so we're going to kind of talk about that. We're going to cover 70 years here.
Ooh, so you're both 70?
But between your journey and mine is 70 years. So, and, you know, we kind of wanted to talk about healing from trauma through poetry.
Yes, for sure.
And we have two different kinds of stories.
Deborah, your background, and then we'll start with your healing, you know, like where you grow up and some of your background for just a minute. And then we can start talking about, yeah, your trauma and then bringing poetry into how you healed.
And kind of came together. And yeah.
Okay. I was born in San Luis Obispo. And my dad was a prison guard at the California Men's Colony where we met. And the night I was born, he was chasing an escaped convict. So he missed my birth.
Oh my gosh.
And then he didn't stay in the prison system. He ended up being like a construction superintendent on aerospace and different things. So we moved a lot. So 45 years after I first went to CMC to have a meal with my parents and sister, and I apparently said, "Daddy, I like eating at the joint." So like 45 years later, I got a job there.
Wow, was it? Yeah, like a foreshadowing. Yeah, that's interesting. Do you feel like that really is like because your dad worked there and you had some experience there, that that's what drew you there later to want to help people in prison? Or is there a different reason for that?
You know, I have been committed to social justice since I was a teenager. So I think it makes sense that I ended up there. But, you know, by the time I took that job, my dad was dead. And he never got to know that circle. But a lot of, I talk about my upbringing and working in the prison in my book, Hummingbird and Underworld.
Yeah, that sounds so interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
To read that for sure.
Yeah, is there anything you want to tell us from about that time? Just like a brief synopsis maybe of the book, just to give the listeners a little bit more of an idea. And if they want to learn more, they can read it. But yeah, I'd like to know, you know, if you have any other details you'd like to share about that time.
I just kind of braid my own story in with working in the prison. And George actually is in this. He has quite a large role. I guess I'm just trying to make prison real to people from the perspective of trying to help people.
Yeah, I think that was what Jorge or George, that was so interesting for us because we'd never talked to anybody in prison or had been in gangs. And it does humanize people, like humanizes people in gangs, humanizes people that are in prison, and realize that some people are just given a really like hard life, and it's hard to keep yourself out of those things. And so he was so inspiring. And so, and obviously you guys were such a huge role in why he was able to kind of heal from all the trauma of being in the gangs and in prison and come to be where he is today, because his story was just so inspiring. We were just like awed by him and just loved chatting with him. So I love that you guys have a part in that, and sounds like a very big part in helping him, you know, have this art and the poetry to help him kind of look internally, become vulnerable, and be able to heal. That's just, it's awesome. So yeah, I really want to read that book.
Yeah, for sure. Book.
So Elizabeth, I'm not going to say Forrest Gump, but she was in the heart of the hippie culture in the 60s and happened to hang out with a bunch of famous people.
Ooh.
Okay, go ahead.
I grew up in LA and I went to UCLA. And after I graduated, that's when I started being a welfare worker. But before, but during that time, I became, well, I met Jim Morrison at UCLA.
Oh, wow.
You know who he is, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Before he became famous. And we were really close friends for a couple of years. And then he went on his musical journey and I went to San Francisco because it spoke to me. And I lived there for about 4 years and in and around in the city and outside of the city. And that's where most of my adventures occurred.
Do you want to share anything more about the adventures? Because that sounds really interesting to me.
Well, I worked as a welfare worker in San Francisco. And the last year that I did that, I had my clients were all hippies and gypsies, now referred to, you know, now they want to be called the ROM people. But I was a social worker by day, but I was like a hippie by night.
I love it.
Yeah.
So I indulged myself in a lot of different experiences and substances. Some of them were good and some of them were not so good, but it must have been my path because it's what I did. I lived right in the Haight-Ashbury and met people like Janis Joplin and the Grateful Dead and
Mick Jagger.
Well, I met him in LA, but I just happened to be in the right place at the right time sometimes.
Do you have a poem from that?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I wrote the book Spirits is about all the substances that I indulged in.
Okay.
So I will read a poem. The title is Heroin. I can't remember his name or face, the time or place in the haze of the late 60s when he said, to understand heroin, you must try it. I do. A warm womb-like feeling snakes through my veins. The slow, steady rush wraps my body in a blanket. Pinpoint pupils look within until the itch for the next fix begins. Wow. That was a low point in my life.
Beautifully written, but
yeah, it is very. Yeah. So were you able to just kind of dabble in those drugs?
Yes.
Like heroin and different?
Okay. I wasn't. My sisters, who were both serious smoker, they said, you're not a serious smoker, because I would smoke, you know, occasionally if I was talking and drinking. Well, I was a dabbler in drugs. I tried all kinds of drugs.
But you weren't an addict. You didn't become an addict. It was easy
didn't. No.
Uh-uh. Try different things and kind of move on from them. That's interesting. Super interesting.
So, but I wanted to talk about, I kind of had a triple whammy starting in 2020. Well, the pandemic got locked down on March 19th, which was my parents' anniversary. So I remember that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And right around that time, my mother's health began to fail.
Her mother was living with her.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We lived And then I became her caretaker. And then in 2022, she went into hospice. So became more intense, her needs. And then also in 2022, I was diagnosed with advanced stage ovarian cancer. Mm-hmm. So I was caring for my mom and going through chemo.
Wow.
And but I want to turn it back to my friend Elizabeth, because you have more to your story.
Yeah, well, I think what I'd like to share how I got to the prison.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
When I finally moved to San Luis Obispo County, where I've lived for almost since 1979, I'd become a parent. I had become a teacher, and I could not get hired in the public schools. So I went to work in, we had a, what was known as the Youth Authority, which was prison for guys 16 to 21. Of course, we have a juvenile hall. We also have a mental hospital for criminally insane men. And I worked in all of those, and I finally graduated to CMC, where I met Deborah. But my final, when I was working at juvenile hall, and what had happened to me, that my trauma, I guess I'll talk about my trauma. I was raped by the Hell's Angels in 1969, and I could not deal with it. You know, for 20 years, I buried it. And it finally, when I was working at juvenile hall, I was asked to preview a film on date rape, because there were a lot of date rapes happening at Cal Poly, which is our university located in San Luis. And I said, okay. I was a teaching assistant there. So I watched the film and I said, oh yeah, you can show it to the kids. So then the day came when we had to watch the film. I had a breakdown. I couldn't deal with it. I ran out of the room and I was shaking, and my bosses said, what's going on? And that's when I told that this had happened to me. And so they sent me to the Rape Crisis Center, and the woman who interviewed me said to me, why don't you go work at the prison with people like that? It might help you.
Oh, wow.
And it helped me. So she had been raped. She felt that it was helping her. And I thought, in your dreams, lady.
Right. Yeah.
But I needed the work, and I was offered a job and I took it. So I worked for 20 years with people, a lot of whom were rapists.
Right.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. When I read your story, you know, your little, some information you guys sent us, I was thinking of that. I'm sure I was thinking, wow, she was raped, and then she probably works with rapists. And it's interesting that it ended up being a healing thing rather, you know, than the opposite. But I can imagine why you buried that, because it's a very awful traumatic experience. And I'm sorry that happened to you. But then to have it come out in that way, and then to turn around and work with people, that is very, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Okay. The 60s were a wild time, but I came from my mother was a nurse. My father was an attorney. He worked for the government. I came from a very middle class, make it look good family. And so this was, I have two sisters and a brother, two of whom are not with us anymore. We all rebelled.
Wow.
You know,
all of you, huh?
It was, so I hid a lot of myself. I mean, I don't know that my parents ever knew what happened to me, because I didn't tell them.
Wow.
And when you bury trauma like that, it comes out eventually.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember, well, whenever we write a new poem, we send it to each other. Yeah. We're the first person the other awesome. Sends a poem to. And I remember her working on this and thinking how brave she is, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's exactly the word.
Read it out loud. And I just have so much admiration for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing.
I'm still a little reluctant.
I'm sure that's probably a really hard thing to share.
Deborah's been much better at marketing her work.
What?
Yeah. Well, than me. Oh, okay. Than me. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking how brave it was for you to take that job as well. I mean, I know you needed the job, and like you said, but you could have, I'm sure you could have gotten out of it and done something else if you absolutely had to and just couldn't face it. But I don't know. I mean, I think it's really admirable that you decided to go forward with that.
And then, so I started working there in 1989. In 1993, I was diagnosed with a brain tumor. So I had brain surgery. That's why actually, it's not in my brain, in my inner ear. So I lost my hearing here. For me to go back to work with a handicap like that was really, but the staff helped me and the inmates, everybody took care of me. They knew. I never was classified in the handicapped division, but everyone knew that I needed, and they were wonderful to me. So I felt like I owed them too. You know, it was a mutual.
Do you have a poem from the wild days?
Well, I have a lot of poems.
You know, the big trauma after the big trauma. Mm-hmm.
You're good. You're good, Deborah. All right.
Gonna convince you to read it. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, from your book. Yes. Yeah, yeah. I'd love to hear something.
Okay, she wanted me to read something about the Hells Angels. Mm-hmm. Most of the poems, I don't think I can read. You know, I think they're too salacious. So I'll read the after part.
Okay.
I titled it Reflections. After this blood sacrifice on the angel altar, I do not get death, disease, or detention. The portal of transformation opens, and I walk away. Refuse the call, become small. 20 years pass before I begin to talk of it. 10 years pass, more, 10 more years pass before I begin to write of it. 3 more years pass before I begin to accept my metamorphosis. When I finally write about this blood mystery rite, I free myself from this bondage. Healing begins. The door of creativity opens and I enter. I sing songs of sorrow that will free me. Silence holds me hostage, keeps me clipped wings crippled. I must share my story, reshape my silence into song. Silence is my captor. I sing songs of memory. I sing songs of reformation. I desire the grace of release.
Wow. That was beautiful.
Yeah.
So very powerful.
Yeah.
And I think it's so important. We hear this all the time, and that's why we have this platform, is to have a podcast for people to share their stories. Because like you're saying, if you keep things in, you can't heal, and you have to let it out. And you need, whether it's in poems or poetry, art, speaking, talking, whatever it is, it can be so healing. And that was beautiful.
Yeah. 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 So I wondered, and you know, this question, I mean, I feel like these stories, I don't know, it's like, it's so different, you know, than anything I've experienced. So I hope everything that I, you know, maybe ask seem sensitive and everything, but I wondered, you said you had healing from taking that job and being around those people, you know, not the people that actually did the act, but like people that were like that, but then also your poetry. So I wondered, like, I think you got healed. It sounds like you experienced healing from both, like being around people. Maybe was it because it humanized those people that could be rapists, and you kind of understood like how they could get to that, or what was it that helped with the healing working in that prison?
Well, I even when I first started working as a welfare worker, and some of the people I worked with took it personally. They felt like the people who needed help didn't deserve it, and I never felt that way. I think I was into social justice too. So at the prison, actually, it was a teacher who gave me a gift of words, a fellow teacher. And she said to me, our job as teachers in prisons is to see the face of God behind the mask of the con.
Julie.
Mm-hmm. And I was like a tutor. I was, do you know what Title I is? No Child Left Behind, it's called. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a federal program for neglected and delinquent. I ended up working with young guys. That's why I met George. Mm. So my job was to fill in the holes of their education, like they needed fractions or they needed grammar or but really, I saw my job as shining a light on the something in them, looking for something good in them, and shining a light and making them, helping them to believe that we're all children of God, that they had something good, to try to turn them around and give them a reason to keep going.
Yeah.
I have a question. Who was the hardest to forgive?
What are we talking about?
Your poem.
My poem? Mm-hmm. Okay, I have one more poem.
Yeah, she's giving you all the prompts to make sure you read these beautiful poems. I love it. She is a good friend.
So, for some reason, even though these people, we had inmate TAs. We had inmate
teaching
assistants. And I had only one, and I was there 20 years. I hired a lot of them. Only one did I ever hire who had a history of rape. And I tell a story in this book. That's not what I'm going to read. It was hard. It was very hard. I never hired another one who was in there for rape. But this is the poem that I wrote. Oh, I wrote a lot of these poems in this book in the 90s. But when I revised the book, because it has a lot of imagery in it, I put several more poems in. And this one, somebody said to me, you know, you need to forgive the Hell's Angels. I went, yeah, right. So here's the poem. It's called Forgiveness. Rape and repeated abuse, body violated, soul wounded, heart hardened, default mode victim, existed on excess, alcohol, drugs, sex, blame, shame, guilt, sadness, secrets, silence. Taught in prisons for 30 years, married and divorced a sociopath. Hepatitis C, cured, 5 abortions, brain tumor, surgery, recovering, tapped into the unseen world. self-light, soul light, light of the world, soul of the planet, the divas, flora and fauna of my mother's garden, senses forever altered and expanded, transformation, a long journey of writing about my life, forgiving my abusers, forgiving myself, opening to love.
Beautiful. Mm. That is beautiful. Thanks for sharing that.
So yeah, I had to forgive myself.
Yeah, that part hit me.
For sure.
Because I do think that a lot of times in this situation with rape, women do take it on and it's so awful and they feel like I shouldn't have been here and I should have been doing that. And they take this responsibility of something that they're not responsible for.
Oh, yeah. I felt I was with the wrong person in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah. But it wasn't your fault. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Thank you. That was powerful.
Yeah. It's really neat, like hearing the, you know, hearing a snippet of what you're going to tell us and then hearing the poem. Mm-hmm. And
it's beautiful.
Yeah. I love it. Like it's, yeah. And I feel like you can, you know, kind of read between the lines, we can, and feel the emotion of it. And it's just really neat. So thanks for sharing.
Well, what happened when I had the brain, it really was the brain surgery. When I kind of woke up from it, because it was quite a, you know, I was pretty out of it. And I said, what didn't I get to, what was it I almost didn't get to do? Why am I here? You know, what was I supposed to be doing with this life? And I knew that I had always known that I was supposed to write, but I didn't. I mean, even Jim, when he was just starting with the band that the Doors, he said, he asked me to write lyrics.
Oh, wow. Mm.
And he said, I'll make you, I'll put them on a record. You'll get royalties. Oh, and wow. I said, oh yeah, the world doesn't need another band. But what I was really saying was, I don't believe in myself.
Yeah.
He believed in me, but I didn't believe in me. Yeah. So when I woke up from the surgery, not literally woke up, but, you know, a few weeks later, my mother was taking care of me. I said, what didn't I get to do? And I knew it was writing. That's when I started writing. Mm. But I still didn't want to write this.
Yeah. Right. About this.
But I have a therapist that I've been working with for years. He went, yeah, that's what you should write. It's your historical reference. You know?
Yeah.
People need to hear it.
Yeah. And it could help so many people because, like we said, women all over the world blame themselves. And if they can hear your story, or they feel like they can't heal from it, or they feel like they can't tell anybody about it. But if they have examples like you of, you know, facing it, dealing with it, getting a therapist, writing about it, and moving on with life and forgiving yourself, that's can help so many people.
Yeah.
My best audience was the first place that I read the book, which was Juvenile Hall. I went back to Juvenile Hall to read it. And Juvenile Hall, this is a small county, it's a small town. So there are maybe 40 kids, 10 of whom were girls. That was the ratio, mostly boys. So they were all invited to come to the reading. A lot of the guys wouldn't come. They were my best audience because afterwards they started talking. The girls started, because most of them had been incested and raped and, you know, molested. The guys had a really hard time with it, but they got it. A lot of people don't want to hear this.
Right. You want to pretend it's not happening. Yeah. And ignore it.
Anyway.
Yeah. And I think, you know, walking beside Elizabeth as she was doing this helped me when 2020 happened. You know, you guys are young. So that is the year I turned 65. Most of my friends are older than me. And so we're in that segment of the population where, oh, it could kill you. you know,
COVID. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Everyone in my house, my partner, my mother, and I were in that portion of the population. So, I mean, it was Amazon, DoorDash, Instacart.
Go anywhere.
Yeah.
And then I was afraid if I did go somewhere, I could bring it back home and kill my mother. You know, who was in her 80s. So I wrote about that. And I have a book called Hindsight and not published yet. But,
So
Elizabeth talked about after her brain surgery, you know, have I done what I'm supposed to do? And for me, during the pandemic, it was like, same thing. Did I do everything I was supposed to do? And, you know, I'm a poet, so we take things harder. And I was really, it was profound thinking about, am I going to see my grandson graduate? You know, and struggling with my own mortality while my mom was dying and I'm taking care of her.
No, you're fine.
Yeah, while you had cancer as well.
Well, that didn't happen yet, but in the early days, I wrote about it. I wish I were a hawk. An Australian family discovers a live koala bear in their Christmas tree. I wish I were a bear. Bears may have a split second to recognize that their lives are over, but they don't obsess about their mortality for years in advance. They aren't haunted by lines from Hamlet's monologue, "What dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil." Bears, they just live until they die. So I found myself like wanting to be an animal.
Right. And not dwell on it. Yeah. And stress about it.
Yeah.
That makes so much sense.
And so 2020, 2021, and I'm on double lockdown. And some of my friends are starting to go out again, but then my mom is getting worse and worse. And then the beginning of 2022, she went into hospice in our home, and it became more intense, you know. And suddenly, and I think a lot of people who have cared for a loved one would recognize how your roles are reversed. So everything she did for me when I was a baby, a little girl, I was doing for her. Right. And she was such a beautiful woman. And it was just so hard to watch her lose agency. You know, she was always very strong, taking care of other people. And then suddenly I'm, you know, her. Yeah. So I wrote a poem about that. And I didn't write a lot. I just wrote when I could, because the caretaking was pretty involved. But Ode to Morphine. Who knew it would be blue? I fill the dropper. My mother opens her mouth like a baby bird. Baby bird, that's your new nickname, I say. I think it's sky blue, the morphine, but I need to know the exact color of the elixir that transports her. So I Google color of morphine and find an analogy by poet Sarah Hanna, who tended to her dying mother. Pale blue Canterbury bells are the color of liquid morphine, she wrote. Of course, a poet is the one who gives the answer. Her mother was an artist who loved flowers. My mother is not an artist, but my father called her his little flower.
I lost my mom in 2020, and she was also on hospice, and we also had to give her morphine. So that was, it's so hard to watch your parents pass away.
Yeah.
Because, like you said, they used to take care of you, and then now you're taking care of them, and they're losing, yeah, who they are. They're losing their agency.
Yeah.
They're losing, you know, everything that made them them, and you have to watch it happen, and it's so hard.
It's so hard.
Yeah. My dad, I mean, we had a hospice, but my dad pretty much did everything for her and never left her side. And we would come and try to help him and have him take a break, but he wouldn't do it. He would just stay with her. But, and you just didn't want him to be in pain.
Right.
And so you would give him the morphine. But then I felt like when she, you know, had the morphine, she was really not herself any even more.
Yeah.
It's hard. So, yeah. Sorry for your loss.
Yeah, I'm sorry for yours.
Thank you.
But then at the same time, you know, I was grateful that she could be home and not in some facility.
Right. Same. Yeah.
And I have to give a shout out. We're in three writers groups together. And I have to give a shout out to the Athena poets who we did online at first and then eventually in person. But they and my friends were so supportive and, you know, sent us dinners and dropped off food and just stood by me through that. So 2020, she went into hospice in January, and then in July, as if it couldn't get any worse, I was diagnosed with advanced stage ovarian cancer. So I had to have surgery and then chemo, and still care for her. And I remember, you know, the day after chemo, at first, the first one was, oh, I got this. But then your body learns the poison. And I remember sometime in there, it would be the day after that would just hit me so hard. And I basically had to crawl into my mom's room to help do something. Wow. Anyway.
Wow.
And I just want to talk about, you know, everyone knows chemo is horrible and everyone's concerned and like, how are you doing? Oh, I'm okay. But body, mind, and spirit are so interwoven. It's not just the chemo. It's not the physical. And especially, you know, ovarian cancer. I've known three people besides me with it, and one is still alive. And so, you know, people want you to stay positive, and, you know, I'm a numbers person. So, see, it was right before my last birthday, I wrote this poem called Birthday by the Numbers. Last November 11th, I turned 67, not yet halfway through my course of chemo. There's a 75% chance that ovarian cancer will recur within 2 years of finishing treatment. I'm hoping to finish this cruel regimen in March or April at the latest. Perhaps on my 68th birthday, I'll be procuring 2 ducks for our Thanksgiving feast. I'll be proofreading my poetry before its planned publication. I'll start packing 1 bag for Prague, imagining standing on the Charles Bridge on December 24th, the lights of the city casting an otherworldly glow. I won't be alone, but standing with my 6 fellow travelers, my newly discovered Czech relatives, and of course, those who came before. Perhaps the spirit of my ancestor, Anna Havlova, born in 1791, will brush against my cheek like a snowflake. I did go to the Czech Republic.
That's what I was going to ask you.
I did.
That's amazing. So that's where your family's from?
My dad's side, yeah.
Oh, that's
I got awesome. To go to 2 ancestral villages where my people lived like 6 generations ago.
Oh, that's awesome.
Wow.
And I got to see the church where my great-grandfather was baptized and my great-great-grandparents got married.
Wow.
And it was amazing. I loved it.
Yeah.
Oh, I bet. I've actually heard that the Czech Republic is such a neat place to visit. And then I can only imagine adding all that personal history would just be just magical. And I love how you ended the poem with the snowflake on your cheek. Like, that was just beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you.
The whole poem just tells a story. I mean, both of you, all the poems that you've shared, and it's so neat. I mean, poetry is just kind of over. I love to hear it, but I can't imagine writing it. Like, it takes
so impressive.
So much creativity. And I think takes a really special, like, thoughtful, wise person. So
yeah. I just go back a little bit. So my mom, she did not pass away of ovarian cancer, but she actually had ovarian cancer in 1984. And so I remember I was 7 and she went through chemo and lost all her hair. And her mom, my grandma, came and lived with us to take care of us kids. There was 3 of us. And I can't even imagine when I remember how sick my mom was after chemo and being in bed and needing my grandma to take her mom to take care of her. I can't imagine that you were like, the energy, all emotional, physical, like all those trying to take care of her while you're trying to heal and deal with maybe, like you said, whether or not you were going to live and when, and you know, when it was going to happen, when your mom was going to pass, like that's got to take such a toll. So I love that in your poem that, you know, that you were able to go, like you said, to the Czech, like you had planned and hoped, and this is where you're going to be next year at this time. And like, with all the things that went on to get you there and then to be able to make it there. That's awesome. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was profound.
Yes.
And my mom died. Let's see. I started chemo. What month?
Well, okay. You got diagnosed in July.
September.
I was in Chicago.
So I started chemo in September.
And when did your mom
die? My mom died November 6th.
She didn't really have help either during that.
Well, I had help from my partner, Jean, and my son, Joseph. But, you know, they're not women.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Different, so, right?
Some things only I could help with.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Wow. Well, you guys are both just amazing women. And I just love your stories and your kind of the triumphs and the heartaches and the trauma and the rising up again. It really is just a beautiful, just life transitions and life story. And
yeah, definitely.
Yeah. What are some other things you guys want to touch on?
Well, this is what we have is our stories.
Yeah.
That's what we have in the end. It's not the things you own. It's your stories.
Yeah. And you guys have yours written down, which is amazing.
Yeah.
I wanted to end with a poem I wrote for Elizabeth.
Oh.
And this was one of our Athena group's homework assignments. And it's called Travels. And I mentioned before we went to Tijuana to see George.
Oh, to see George. Mm-hmm.
And she's been to Paris, but when I went to the Czech Republic,
your layover, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Was Frankfurt, not Paris, dang it. But anyway, here it is. Travels. My adventurous friend, we could be in Paris right now, but for the Greek alphabet of COVID. Yes, we are at Père Lachaise, and I listen as you share how you felt when you learned that Jim had died. You have told me before, but it's different when we are sitting by his grave, just having come from an enchanting cafe. Remember the cafe in Tijuana? You and I waited for George, a little edgy. Edgy in the same way you and I got in prison sometimes. A different adventure. Where are we going next, I wonder? We travel well together. I know you have an idea, and I am ready, my road dog, my dear Elizabeth. And road dog, sorry, is prison slang for friend or homie.
Oh, that's awesome.
And wow. I was in France when Jim died, which it was just total coincidence. I never went to his grave, though.
So who is Jim?
He's buried. Jim Morrison.
Oh, Jim Morrison. Okay, we're going back. Yeah,
what I was thinking when you said that. I'm like, I know.
Yeah. I hadn't been to Europe. I was there, and he was, I didn't know, but he died
when you're in Paris.
We were very close, and then it just was weird. Weird that I was there.
But that was a poem about, you know, when is COVID going to end? And when are we going to go
travel
somewhere?
Again? Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. I love your friendship. That's amazing.
I know. Really amazing. Yeah. And I think it's really, I don't know, just the whole thing that you came together through poetry and just the coincidences of life too, you know, that.
But I have to say the day that we met, it wasn't through poetry. We're both in an office in the prison to see our supervisor. She supervised her program, and I also worked as a sponsor for programs like AA and NA, and this one was the literacy program. I supervised inmates who taught other inmates how to read. And the only way those programs could exist was if a staff person worked, you know, agreed to go back after work and be there during the time that the program was being held. So we both walk into this office, and that's how we met. And I knew, and just knew we'd be friends.
Me too.
It was like, oh, I think we had another life together
or something.
Oh, how cool.
And it was before poet. We didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. So you have this connection. You're both kind of into this social justice. You want to help people. You want to give education in the prison system. And then you also write poems.
Yeah,
you guys are definitely meant to be
friends. I know. And how did you find out that you both were into poetry? Was that a surprise when you found that out? Or?
Oh, I think that was pretty immediate because...
Once you started talking and...
Well, my job was the manager of the arts program. And it's kind of a unique job and you pick whatever discipline you're in and create a program around it. So it was poetry until it turned into theater.
Which is poetry.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
It was pretty quick.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was already writing because it was after. Yes, I was already writing.
So you're saying though, if there's a program in a prison, it's because somebody like you guys, started. So not all prisons have.
There are these programs for Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, literacy. There are these, and there was religious
groups.
Yeah. Any kind of group has to have a sponsor. There has to be a staff member who's paid a small amount of money to just be there so that the program can be held. Because people from the outside cannot be there without a support person, and there are not enough officers to go around.
Yeah.
So I felt after my brain surgery, when I went back to work, when I didn't go back to work after my brain surgery, a time bank was set up for me. People donated their time, their vacation time. So that I never missed a paycheck.
I was
out of work for several months. And I felt I need to give back to this institution that has helped me survive this.
Yeah.
Really difficult ordeal.
Yeah. Definitely.
That's when I started being a sponsor, because it meant very long days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway.
I thought before we go to the wrap up, well, maybe we should ask, is there anything else you guys want to touch on? I also wanted to ask, just because you guys have both been through so much, if you have any advice for listeners. Yeah, like you're just so wise and have so much wisdom and been through so many different things. And then we can, you know, go.
Yeah.
Maybe from there.
Yeah.
Okay. Find your people. Mm. And I would tell my students who were musicians, artists, poets, actors, when you get out of here, find your people. It's very important.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about your arts community, of course. And I think we can agree that that is a mainstay for us.
What?
Being in these writing groups.
Yeah. Yeah.
Community. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I try to look at things that have happened to me or to anybody else to try to figure out what's the message? What did I learn from this? But I try to look through the lens of love, because nothing else makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's probably why you both are working with, people in prison, that you can have this kind of lens of love and give them some grace, to help them find something within them that they can believe in.
Yeah. I think most people, they want to be seen and they want to be heard. recognized in their full humanity. And that's what we can do through our art. I love that.
Yeah. And I do think if people want an example of what the two of you have done is to go and listen to Jorge, episode, because he's come such a long way with the help of you and he just programs like that.
Referenced you guys so much in that too, probably more than anyone else, you know, what impact you had on his life.
And he on ours as well. He inspires me.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he does.
And he was very inspiring. Immensely talented.
Yes, he is. But I have to say about Deborah that she inspires me to watch her working in the prison and outside of the prison with all of these, with the felons and ex-felons, to see her work her magic with these guys that get them to do these things that they never thought they would do. It was phenomenal. I'm just incredible. I mean, I just have such respect for you. I saw it over and over and over. And the guys were...
We're talking about plays.
Yes.
Yeah. The guys had, they really, very few of them ever, most of them had such respect for her and would do what you asked, which was really
that's impressive. Yeah, that is. Yeah.
Because taking advice from a woman is very hard for hardened people.
Yeah.
Inside and out.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
that could be very true. Yeah.
Well, I think it goes to show your character and the time to people that you are, that they would be receptive and respond to you. It's because you do care and that you're wanting to help them. And so they feel that, and you have some sort of belief in them that they would want to respect you and listen to you. And that's awesome.
Definitely. Yeah.
And it was very hard to do what she did because the Department of Corrections, unfortunately, didn't want these guys to succeed. You know, recidivism is job security for people who work in that correctional field. So they were always making it very hard for her because they didn't. Yeah, well, we
and they would tell paroling inmates, bring a friend when you come back, and union was the most powerful union in the state.
Wow,
and
which is so sad.
In my book, actually.
Okay. Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, you would hope that the kind of the idea would be to get people out and never come back, and you know, instead of say, well, when you're back, like not believe, and it's almost the same thing. You're not believing in them. You're like, well, you'll be back, and you'll probably come and bring a friend.
Yeah,
so,
right.
You know,
and things have changed now.
Oh, good.
That's good.
Since we retired, thankfully.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been an amazing conversation. We loved chatting with both of you, and so glad that we were able to, we had some technical difficulties, so we're glad we got those worked out.
Yeah. So glad we could make this happen. It's been, I feel like, a really special episode, and just to see your guys' friendship and all the things, interesting lives that you've had, and just unique and really neat. So we're grateful that you took the time for us.
Yes. And at the end of our episodes, you're welcome. At the end of our episodes, we always ask the question, how do you find beauty in life after going through your life transitions?
In words.
Yes. In words.
Makes sense.
Yeah. It's perfect.
In your poems.
And
in
words.
I mean, just this morning as I was driving, because I live 50 miles away, I was fashioning, I love a title of a book or a poem. I was working out a title for something that I'm going to write. I mean, I just am in love with words.
Me too.
But yeah, they can portray so much meaning and explanation and emotion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Some people do it with color.
Yeah,
some people do it with music.
But I really found, especially during the pandemic, hospice cancer thing, it was only on the page that I could really express the deepest things going on with me and somehow turn terrible things into beautiful poems.
Yeah.
And that's true for me too, because it was, this is what healed me writing this book. I don't feel the same way, that poem of forgiveness. And it's true. I mean, it really was I had to come to forgive myself. So it was healing.
Yeah.
So I recommend it to anyone. But you could do it with painting. You could do it with music. Anything. You could do it with gardening.
Right.
Yeah, any creative process.
You're creative, yeah. And what speaks to you, yeah.
Cooking.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
How'd you get into this? How did you get into
podcasting?
It's a creative hobby.
It is kind of like what you're saying. I think I find beauty in life and I find connection with having conversations with people and hearing their stories. Mm-hmm. So we just, our kids are getting older and we were just wanting to do something with our time that can kind of give meaning to people and to kind of, I don't know, connect with people. So we started the podcast for that. So we could hear people's stories and share those stories and hope that they'll help others, that by sharing your story, we can help other people understand where you guys are coming from and the lessons you've taught as well of all. I mean, we've had almost 60 interviews, I think, of different people with such different stories.
I'm going to listen to the one where you interviewed people who had
Down syndrome.
Oh yeah, that was a really good one.
Yeah, it was amazing. She's a really amazing person.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much. Thank you
for wanting
and
to
thanks for like making the time and driving and
dealing with
our issues. Yes, we really appreciate it. Okay, you take care.
You too.
Okay.
Thanks.
I'll just really quick. So we just want to thank both of you for being here and just to mention your books again. So Deborah's is Hummingbird in Underworld, Teaching in a Men's Prison. And it sounds like you have another book coming out. Is that what you were saying? Maybe.
Not yet.
Okay. So look for this one. And then Elizabeth has one called Naked Lady, a Poetic Memoir of Rape and Recovery. And it sounds like, are they both available on like Amazon and Apple?
Yeah.
Both of your books. Okay. That's just so amazing. And then the Poetic Justice Project, that's on Instagram. People can follow that.
Yes, but I retired from that.
Okay. But that's still something you founded it, but you're retired from that. Okay. All right. Well, this has been an amazing conversation. I love chatting with both of you so much. It was so great to meet you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening today. We hope you enjoyed this conversation and would love if you subscribed to the podcast and followed along as we continue hearing more inspiring stories. You can also follow us on Instagram at Beautiful Shifts Podcast, where we will post updates with our latest interviews.
We'd like to thank the band We the Lion for giving us permission to use their beautiful song Move Along for our podcast. Take a minute to listen to the song and the lyrics and enjoy.
I find a way to know myself. All my thoughts are mine again. And begin to understand where to go. Now it's time to move along. Now it's time to move along. Take this journey as my own. Feel the strength right in my bones. All I want is to believe life is my own. Life is my own. I'll start again. My mind is free now. I can feel the truth. I'll take a chance, I won't be wrong. Yes, now it's time to move along. Now it's time to move along. Take this.